Wow, you think they'll still work?
They should. She grabbed a wrench and tightened the coupler as hard as she dared. They're designed to be submerged, and they're simple. They just need power, which we've got plenty of up here.
Well, what will I do?
Solo wiped his hands, sprinkling breadcrumbs on her workbench. He reached for another piece. You'll be watching the compressor. I'll show you how to crank it, how to top it with fuel. I'm going to install one of the portable deputy radios in the helmet, here, so we can talk back and forth. There'll be a whole mess of hose and electrical wire to play out. She smiled up at him. Don't worry, I'll keep you busy.
Oh, I'm not worried, Solo said.
He puffed out his chest and crunched on a cucumber, his eyes drifting to the compressor. And Juliet saw, just like a teenager with little practice but great need, that Solo had not yet mastered the art of lying convincingly. 8. Silo 18. Boys from the other side of the camp. These results were closely observed by the experimenters, who were posing as camp counselors. When the violence got out of hand, the experiment was halted before it could run its full course. What began at Robber Cave as two sets of boys, all with nearly identical backgrounds and values, had turned into what became known in the field of psychology as an in-grouping and out-grouping scenario. Small perceived differences, the way one wore a hat, the inflections in speech, turned into unforgivable transgressions. When stones started flying and the raids on each other's camps turned bloody, there was no recourse for the experimenters but to put an end to... Lucas couldn't read anymore. He closed the book and leaned back against the tall shelves. He smelled something foul, brought the spine of the old book to his nose and sniffed. It was him, he finally decided. When was the last time he'd showered? His routine was all out of whack. There were no screaming kids to wake him up in the morning, no evenings hunting for stars, no dimmed stairwell to guide him back to his bed so he could repeat it all the following day. Instead, it was fitful periods of tossing and turning in the hidden bunk room of level 35. A dozen bunks, but him all alone. It was flashing red lights to signal that he had company, conversations with Bernard and Peter Billings when they brought him food, long talks with Juliet whenever she called and he was free to answer. Between it all, the books. Books of history out of order, of billions of people, of even more stars. Stories of violence, of the madness of crowds, of the staggering timeline of life, of orbited suns that would one day burn out, of weapons that could end it all, of diseases that nearly had. How long could he go on like this, reading and sleeping and eating? The weeks already felt like months. There was no keeping track of the days, no way to remember how long he'd had on this pair of coveralls, if it was time to change out of them and into the pair in the dryer. Sometimes he felt like he changed and washed his clothes 3 times a day. It could easily have been 2x a week. It smelled like longer. He leaned his head back against the tins of books and closed his eyes. The things he was reading couldn't all be true. It made no sense. A world so crowded and strange. When he considered the scale of it all, the idea of this life burrowed beneath the earth, sending people to clean, getting worked up over who stole what from whom, he sometimes felt a sort of mental vertigo, this frightening terror of standing over some abyss, seeing a dark truth far below, but unable to make it out before his senses returned and reality snatched him back from the edge. He wasn't sure how long he sat like that, dreaming of a different time and place, before he realized the throbbing red lights had returned. Lucas returned the book to its tin and struggled to his feet. The computer screen showed Peter Billings at the server door, as deep as he was allowed into the room. A tray with Lucas's dinner sat on top of the work log filing cabinet inside the door. He turned away from the computer, hurried down the corridor, and scrambled up the ladder. After removing the grate, he carefully dropped it back into place and picked a circuitous path through the tall, humming servers.
Ah, here's our little protege.
Peter smiled, but his eyes narrowed at the sight of Lucas. Lucas dipped his chin.
"Sheriff," he said.
He always had this sense that Peter was silently mocking him, looking down on him, even though they were about the same age. Whenever he showed up with Bernard, especially the day Bernard had explained the need to keep Lucas safe, there had seemed some sort of competitive tension between them. A tension Lucas was aware of, even if he didn't share it. In private, Bernard had committed Lucas to secrecy and told him that he was grooming Peter for the eventual job of mayor, that he and Lucas would one day work hand in hand. Lucas tried to remember this as he slid the tray off the cabinet. Peter watched him, his brow lowered in thought. Lucas turned to go.
"Oh, why don't you sit here and eat?"
Peter asked, not budging from where he leaned against the thick server room door. Lucas froze.
"I see you sitting here with Bernard while you eat, but you're always in a hurry to scurry off when I come by."
Peter leaned out and peered into the stacks of servers.
"What is it you do in here all day, anyway?"
Lucas felt trapped. In truth, he wasn't even all that hungry, had thought about saving it for later, but eating his food to completion was usually the fastest way out of these conversations. He shrugged and sat down on the floor, leaned against the work log cabinet, and stretched his legs out in front of him. Uncovering the tray revealed a bowl of unidentifiable soup, 2 slices of tomato, and a piece of cornbread.
"I work on the servers mostly, just like before."
He started with a bite of the bread, something bland. "Only difference is I don't have to walk home at the end of the day." He smiled at Peter while he chewed the dry bread.
"Well, that's right. You live down in the mids, don't you?"
Peter crossed his arms and seemed to get even more comfortable against the thick door. Lucas leaned to the side and gazed past him down the hallway. Voices could be heard around the corner. He had a sudden impulse to get up and run, just for the sake of running.
"Barely," he answered. "My apartment's practically in the up-top." "All the mids are," Peter laughed, "to those who live there."
Lucas worked on the cornbread to keep his mouth occupied. He eyed the soup warily while he chewed.
"Did Bernard tell you about the big assault we've got planned? I was thinking of going down to take part."
Lucas shook his head. He dipped his spoon into the soup.
"You know that wall mechanical built? How those idiots boxed themselves in? Well, Sims and his boys are going to blast it to smithereens. They've had all the time in the world to work on it from our side, so this little rebellion nonsense should be over in a few days, max."
Slurping the hot soup, all Lucas could think about was the men and women of Mechanical trapped behind that wall of steel, and how he knew precisely what they were going through.
"Does that mean I'll be out of here soon?"
He pressed the edge of his spoon into an underripe tomato rather than use the knife and fork.
"There can't be any threat out there for me, can there? Nobody even knows who I am." "Oh, that's up to Bernard. He's been acting strange lately. A lot of stress, I suppose."
Peter slid down the door and rested on his heels. It was nice for Lucas to not have to crane his neck to look up at him.
"He did say something about bringing your mother up for a visit. I took that to mean you might be in here at least a week longer."
"Great." Lucas pushed his food around some more. When the distant server started buzzing, his body practically jerked as if tugged by some string. The overhead lights winked faintly, meaningful to those in the know.
"Well, what's that?"
Peter peered into the server room, rising on his toes a little.
"That means I need to get back to work."
Lucas handed him the tray. "Thanks for bringing this." He turned to go.
"Hey, the mayor said to make sure you ate everything."
Lucas waved over his shoulder. He disappeared around the first tall server and began to jog toward the back of the room, wiping his mouth with his hand, knowing Peter couldn't follow.
"Lucas!"
But he was gone. He hurried toward the far wall, digging his keys out of his collar as he went. While he worked on the locks, he saw the overhead lights stop their flashing. Peter had closed the door. He removed the back panel and dug the headphones out of their pouch, plugged them in.
"Hello?"
He adjusted his microphone, making sure it wasn't too close.
"Hey."
Her voice filled him up in a way mere food couldn't.
"Did I make you run?"
Lucas took a deep breath. He was getting out of shape living in such confinement, not walking to and from work every day.
No, he lied. But maybe you should go easy with the calling. At least during the day, you know who is in here all the time. Yesterday, when you let it ring so long, we were sitting right beside the server while it buzzed and buzzed. It really pissed him off.
You think I care if he gets angry? Juliet laughed. And I want him to answer. I'd love to talk to him some more. Besides, what would you suggest? I want to talk to you. I need to talk to someone. And you're always right there. It's not like you can call me and expect me to be here waiting. Hell, I'm all over the damn place over here. You know how many times I've been from the 30s to supply in the last week? Guess.
I don't want to guess. Lucas rubbed his eyelids.
Probably a half dozen times. And you know, if he's in there all the time, you could just do me a favor and kill him for me. Save me all this trouble.
Kill him? Lucas waved his arm. What, just bludgeon him to death?
Do you really want some pointers? Because I've dreamt up a number of...
No, I don't want pointers. And I don't want to kill anybody. I never did.
Lucas dug his index finger into his temple and rubbed in tiny, forceful circles. These headaches were forever popping up. They had been ever since.
Ugh, forget it, Juliet said, the disgust in her voice zipping through the wires at the speed of light.
Look, Lucas readjusted his mic. He hated these conversations. He preferred it when they just talked about nothing.
I'm sorry, it's just that... things are crazy over here. I don't know who's doing what. I'm in this box with all this information. I've got this radio that just blares people fighting all the time, and yet I seem to know rat shit compared to everyone else.
But you know you can trust me, right? That I'm one of the good guys? I didn't do anything wrong to be sent away, Lucas. I need you to know that.
He listened as Juliet took in a deep breath and let it out with a sigh.
He imagined her sitting over there, alone in that silo with a crazy man, the mic pressed to her lips, her chest heaving with exasperation, her mind full of all these expectations of him.
Lucas, you do know that I'm on the right side here, don't you? And that you're working for an insane man?
Everything's crazy, he said. Everyone is. I do know this. We were sitting here in IT, hoping nothing bad would happen, and the worst things we could think of came to us.
Juliet released another deep breath, and Lucas thought about what he had told her of the uprising, the things he had omitted.
I know what you say my people did, but do you understand why they came? Do you? Something needed to be done, Luke. It still needs doing.
Lucas shrugged, forgetting she couldn't see him. As often as they chatted, he still wasn't used to conversing with someone like this.
You're in a position to help, she told him.
I didn't ask to be here. He felt himself growing frustrated. Why did their conversations have to drift off to bad places? Why couldn't they go back to talking about the best meals they'd ever had, their favorite books as kids, the likes and annoyances they had in common?
None of us ask to be where we are, she reminded him coolly.
This gave Lucas pause, thinking of where she was, what she'd been through to get there.
What we control, Juliet said, is our actions once fate puts us there.
I probably need to get off. Lucas took a shallow breath. He didn't want to think of actions and fate. He didn't want to have this conversation. Pete'll be bringing me my dinner soon, he lied. There was silence. He could hear her breathing. It was almost like listening to someone think.
Okay, she said. I understand. I need to go test the suit anyway, and hey, I might be gone a while if this thing works, so if you don't hear from me for a day or so...
Just be careful, Lucas said.
I will. And remember what I said, Luke. What we do going forward defines who we are. You aren't one of them. You don't belong there. Please, don't forget this.
Lucas mumbled his agreement,
and Juliet said goodbye, her voice still in his ears as he reached in and unplugged the jack. Rather than slot the headphones into their pouch, he slumped back against the server behind him, wringing the ear pads in his hands, thinking about what he had done, about who he was. He felt like curling up into a ball and crying, just closing his eyes and making the world go away. But he knew, if he closed them, if he allowed himself to sink into darkness, all he would see there is her. That small woman, with the gray hair, her body jumping from the impacts of the bullets, Lucas's bullets. He would feel his finger on the trigger, his cheeks wet with salt, the stench of spent powder, the table ringing with the clink of empty brass and with the jubilant and victorious cries of the men and women he had aligned himself with. 9. Silo 18.
Said Thursday that I'd get it to you in 2 days.
Well, damn it, it's been 2 days, Carl. You do realize the cleaning's tomorrow morning, right?
And you realize that today is still today, don't you?
Don't be a smartass. Get me that file and get it up here pronto. I swear, if this shit falls through because you were...
I'll bring it. Come on, man. I'm busting your balls. Relax.
Relax? Screw you. I'll relax tomorrow. I'm getting off the line. Now don't dick around.
I'm coming right now.
Shirley held the sides of her head, her fingers tangled in her hair, elbows digging into Walker's workbench. "What in the depths is going on?" she asked him. "Walk, what is this? Who are these people?" Walker peered through his magnifiers. He dipped the single bristle plucked from the cleaning brush into the white paint on the wet lid of primer. With utmost care, his other hand steadying his wrist, he dragged the bristle across the outside of the potentiometer directly opposite the fixed mark he'd painted on the knob itself. Satisfied, he counted the ticks he'd made so far, each one marking the position of another strong signal.
11,
he said. He turned to Shirley, who had been saying something, he wasn't sure what.
And I don't think we've found ours yet.
Ours? Walk, this is freaking me out. Where are these voices coming from? He shrugged.
The city? Over the hills? How should I know?
He started spinning the knob slowly, listening for more chatter.
11 besides us. Ooh, what if there's more? There has to be more, right? What are the chances we've found them all already?
That last one was about a cleaning. Do you think they meant, like... Walker nodded, sending his magnifiers out of whack. He readjusted them, then went back to tuning the dial. So they're in silos? Like us? He pointed to the tiny green board she'd helped him wire the potentiometer to.
It must be what this circuit does. Modulates the wave frequency, maybe.
Shirley was freaking out over the voices. He was more fascinated in these other mysteries. There was a crackle of static. He paused in turning the knob, scrubbed back and forth across it, but found nothing. He moved on.
You mean the little board with the number 18 on it?
Walker looked at her dumbly. His fingers stopped their searching. He nodded.
So there's at least that many, she said, putting it together quicker than he had. I've got to find Jenkins. We've got to tell him about this.
Shirley left her stool and headed for the door. Walker bobbed his head. The implications made him dizzy, the bench and walls seeming to slide sideways. The idea of people beyond these walls. A violent roar rattled his teeth and shook the thought loose. His feet slipped out from underneath him as the ground trembled, decades of dust raining down from the tangle of pipes and wires crisscrossing overhead. Walker rolled to his side, coughing, breathing the musky mildew drifting in the air. His ears were ringing from the blast. He patted his head, groping for his magnifiers, when he saw the frame lying on the steel decking before him, the lens broken into gravel-sized shards.
Oh, no! I need...
He tried to get his hands underneath him, felt a twinge in his hip, a powerful ache where bone had smacked steel. He couldn't think. He waved his hand, begging Scotty to come out of the shadows and help him. A heavy boot crunched what remained of his magnifiers. Strong, young hands gripped his coveralls, pulling him to his feet. There was shouting everywhere, the pop and rattle of gunfire.
Walk, you okay?
Jenkins held him by his coveralls. Walker was pretty sure he would collapse if the boy let go.
My magna... Sir, we've got to go. They are inside.
Walker turned toward the door, saw Harper helping Shirley to her feet. Her eyes were wide, stunned, a film of gray dust on her shoulders and in her dark hair. She was looking toward Walker, appearing as senseless as he felt.
Get your things, Jenkins said. We're falling back.
He scanned the room, eyes drifting to the workbench.
I fixed it,
Walker said, coughing into his fist.
It works.
A little too late, I think.
Jenkins let go of his coveralls, and Walker had to catch himself on his stool to not go tumbling back to the ground. The gunfire outside drew nearer. Boots thundered by, more shouting, another loud blast that could be felt through the floor. Jenkins and Harper were at the doorway shouting orders and waving their arms at the people running past. Shirley joined Walker at his workbench. Her eyes were on the radio.
Oh, we need this, she said, breathing hard.
Walker looked down at the glittering jewels on the floor. 2 months' wages for those magnifiers.
Walk! What do I grab? Help me!
He turned to find Shirley gathering up the radio parts, the wires between the boards folded up, tangled. There was a single loud pop from one of the good guns right outside his door, causing him to cower, his mind to wander.
Walk!
The antenna,
he whispered, pointing to where the dust was still drifting from the rafters. Shirley nodded and jumped up on his workbench. Walker looked around the room, a room he promised himself he would never leave again, a promise he really had meant to keep this time. What to grab? Stupid mementos? Junk? Dirty clothes? A pile of schematics? He grabbed his parts bin and dumped it out on the floor. The radio components were swept in, the transformer unplugged from its outlet and added. Shirley was yanking down the antenna, the wires and metal rods bundled against her chest. He snatched his soldering iron, a few tools. Harper yelled that it was now or never. Shirley grabbed Walker by the arm and pulled him along toward the door. And Walker realized it was going to be never. 10. Silo 17. The panic she felt from donning the suit was unexpected. Juliet had anticipated some degree of fear from slipping into the water, but it was the simple act of putting on the cleaning suit that filled her with a hollow dread, that gave her a cold and empty ache in the pit of her stomach. She fought to control her breathing while Solo zipped up the back and pressed the layers of Velcro into place.
"Where's my knife?"
she asked him, patting the pockets on the front and searching among her tools.
"It's over here," he said.
He bent down and fished it out of her gear bag, out from under a towel and change of clothes. He passed her the knife, handle first, and Juliet slotted it into the thick pocket she'd added on the suit's belly. It was easier to breathe, just having it within reach. This tool from the upper cafe was like a security blanket of sorts. She found herself checking for it the way she used to check her wrist for that old watch.
"Let's wait on the helmet," she told Solo as he lifted the clear dome from the landing. "Grab that rope first."
She pointed with her puffy mitts. The thick material and the two layers of undersuit were making her warm. She hoped that boded well for not freezing to death in the deep water. Solo lifted the coils of spliced rope. A large, adjustable wrench the length of his forearm knotted at the end.
"Which side?"
he asked. She pointed to where the gracefully curving steps plunged into the green-lit water.
"Lower it over, steady, and hold it out so it doesn't get caught on the steps below."
He nodded. Juliet checked her tools while he dropped the wrench into the water, the weight of the hunk of metal tugging the rope straight down to the very bottom of the great stairwell. In one pocket, she had a range of drivers. Each one was tied off with a few feet of string. She had a spanner in another pocket, cutters behind pocket number 4. Looking down at herself, more memories flooded back from her walk outside. She could hear the sound of fine grit pelting her helmet, could sense her air supply running thin, could feel the clomp of her heavy boots on the packed earth. She gripped the railing ahead of her and tried to think of something else, anything else. Wire for power and hose for air. Concentrate. She would need a lot of both. She took a deep breath and checked the tall coils of tubing and electrical wire laid out on the deck. She had flaked them in figure 8 so they would be impossible to tangle. Good. The compressor was ready. All Solo had to do was make sure everything fed down to her, didn't get caught up.
"It's on the bottom," Solo said.
She watched him knot the line to the stairway railing. He was in good spirits today, lucid and energetic. This would be a good time to get it over with. Shifting the flood to the treatment plant would have been an inelegant temporary solution. It was time to get those big pumps down below churning through that water properly, pumping it through the concrete walls and back into the earth beyond. Juliet shuffled to the edge of the landing and looked down at the silvery surface of the foul water. Was this plan of hers crazy? Shouldn't she be afraid? Or was it the years of waiting and doing this safely that was more terrifying to her? The prospect of going mad, inch by inch, seemed the greater risk. This would be just like going outside, she reminded herself, which she had already done and had survived. Except this was safer. She was taking an unlimited supply of air, and there was nothing toxic down there, nothing to eat away at her. She gazed at her reflection in the still water, the bulky suit making her look enormous. If Lucas were standing there with her, if he could see what she was about to do, would he try to talk her out of it? She thought he might. How well did they really know each other? They had, what, 2, 3 encounters in person? But then there were the dozens of talks since. Could she know someone from just his voice? From stories about his childhood? From his intoxicating laughter when everything else in her day made her want to cry? Was this why wires and emails were made expensive, to prevent this kind of life, this kind of relationship? How could she be standing there, thinking of a man she hardly knew, rather than the insanity of the task before her? Maybe Lucas had become her lifeline, some slender thread of hope connecting her to home. Or was he more like a tiny spot of light seen occasionally through the murk, a beacon guiding her return?
Helmet?
Solo stood beside her, watching her, the clear plastic dome in his hands, a single flashlight strapped to its top. Juliet reached for it. She made sure the flashlight was securely fastened and tried to clear her head of pointless ruminations.
Hook up my air first, she said, and turn on the radio.
He nodded. He held the dome while he clicked the air hose into the adapter she'd threaded through the collar. There was a hiss and spit of residual air from the line as it locked into place.